preceding what we're looking at this morning, just for context. And I read in verse 12, and it says, "And I turned to see the voice which spoke with me, and turning, I saw seven golden lampstands." And in verse 16, "And having in his right hand seven stars," then reading in verse 17, "And when I saw him, I fell before his feet as dead. And he placed his right hand upon me, saying, Do not fear, I am the first and the last. I'm the one who lives and who is dead. And behold, I live forever and ever. And I have the keys of death and Hades. Therefore write what you have seen, and what is, and what is about to come after these things. The mystery of the seven stars which you saw in my right hand, and the seven golden lampstands. The seven stars are the seven angels, are the angels of the seven churches, and the seven lampstands are the seven churches." We look here in this passage, and John says, "I fell down in holy dread. I fell as dead when I saw the one that was speaking with me." And so we find John here. I mean, he is an apostle. He's walked with Jesus. He's been with Jesus. He's been a very intimate friend, haven't they? In fact, the Gospel of John describes John as the one that was in the bosom of Christ, and that he was the beloved. In fact, he never identifies himself other than being the one whom Jesus loved. So a very close relationship. So why would one that was so close to Jesus in his earthly ministry and spent so much time with him and so intimate that he was within this inner circle of three, why would he, when he saw him in heaven, fall down like one who's dead? Why would there be a holy terror that came over him in his life? You see, I think that there's going to be a great discrepancy from what we think we have in our walk and relationship here in this life, as we have been so casual in our walk with God. I think there's going to be a discrepancy here from what it will be like when we actually see him face to face. I don't think they're going to be the same. I don't think the walk that you and I have with him here is going to be what we have with him there. How easy is it to overlook and to neglect and just to forfeit what we can have with God because of Jesus Christ now? How easy is it for us to give up the intimacy and the fellowship and the time that we can have with God right now, the Lord Jesus Christ right now? How easy is it for us to forfeit that time and to put something else in its place? How easy is it for us to overlook him in our own life experience when we could draw upon all the resources of heaven that we spend our time playing in the sand looking for some kind of answer here when the answer is right there in our presence? How often do we neglect and forfeit what we could have with Jesus Christ now in our earthly experience and then expect that that's what's going to be when we see him face to face? I think that the discrepancy will be equal to what John experienced. He had a close, intimate relationship that you and I don't have. We've never seen him face to face, have we? We've never touched him in his physical humanity. We've never done that. We read about it, and in our own experience, we transfer ourselves there to be like the disciples, and we think that we somehow or another can associate with those things, but we have not had the kind of close fellowship that John had. To be able to sit down at a meal, to be able to sit down and talk. And yet, in a spiritual sense, we can have that because each one of the apostles remind us that we have a like common faith, that our faith is no different than their faith. Whether it was Paul writing to the Galatians or whether it was Peter writing in his second letter talking about our common faith, or Jude in his short letter talking about us defending this like common faith that we have, that there's no difference between what we have and what they had, except in the degree that we're willing to walk in it. And yet, when John sees him in heaven in all of his splendor and glory, what does he do? He falls down as one dead. Now, Matthew 17, when we were going through Matthew, you'll recall we came to a passage where Jesus took with him Peter and James and John, and they went up into a high mountain. And when they got in the mountain and they were with him, that they were overshadowed by a cloud, and the cloud began to speak. And then when the cloud rose, there were standing with Jesus were Moses and Elijah. And as they saw them, they saw the presence of these two magnificent figures of Old Testament history, of two great prophets, and they had a similar experience. They fell down, didn't they? And then the cloud comes, and Peter responds, you know, it's good that we were here. Let us build tabernacles, places of worship here on the mountain so that we can come, one for you and one for Moses, one for Elijah. And the cloud, as it settled down again, they've seen Jesus in his glory, and they've seen these two other men who have reflected, as Moses did when he went into the presence of God at Mount Sinai, have reflected what that holy glory is around the presence of God, and it caused these three disciples to be upon their face. When the cloud receded and the glory of Christ had receded, we find the voice of God saying, "This is my beloved Son. This is the one that you are to worship. This is the one that you are to serve." Making a distinction. So they had a glimpse that you and I have not had as well, haven't they? Of Christ in his unveiled glory. Yet when John saw him, as he is in heaven itself now, his experience was to fall down like one dead. It seems to me that in our experiences, we just sang a couple courses that talk about wanting more, wanting to be closer, wanting a different kind of walk than maybe we have experienced. Is it really our passion and desire? Is it really something that we long for? Is it really something that we really want, that we would really like to have a better walk with Christ than we do now? Or are we so comfortable in the walk that we have and so satisfied that it's not that demanding that we are willing to substitute the insufficiencies of what we have for the greater glory of what we would have if we were to really pursue and seek after the Lord? And I think that's probably the case. When John falls down, it says that he touched him with his right hand and he spoke to him two words. Now it's three in English, but it's only two words in Hebrew or in Greek, and that is, "Do not fear. Do not fear. Don't be afraid." You recall where that first occurred? Do you recall the very first time that God spoke those words to anyone? It was in the book of Joshua in the very first chapter. Moses, the prophet, had died, and all the burden of leadership had fallen upon the shoulders of Joshua. And Joshua was supposed to lead the people across the Jordan River, and as soon as they crossed the Jordan River, they would face their first conflict with the city of Jericho, and he had the responsibility of taking the people who had wandered through the wilderness for 40 years and had left their captivity in Egypt to bring them into the land that God had promised and to overcome and to take that land and to give it to the people, that great responsibility. And the Lord said to him, "Do not fear." Why? When we read this, it's called a salvation oracle because it comes with that formula. And you'll find that it's very frequent in the prophets. And it occurs several times in the literature of 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings. But it comes with a formula. What you expect to hear is an invocation of God. Why we should not fear. Something about who God is or what God has done in the historical past. What has God done? Well, John hears, "Do not fear." But what's the reason? What is it that he knows about Jesus Christ, that he knows about God, right now in his information, in his own experience, what is it that he knows about God that would give him the foundation of basis not to be afraid in the situation that he's in? What gives him the basis, and what's the basis of ours? Because that's the first part of the salvation announcement. What is the reason, what's the assurance of God's character? What does Jesus tell John? He tells him right at the very first, he tells him who he is. You remember Moses when he saw the burning bush, and the bush was speaking, and the bush was burning but not consumed, and he came forward and he began to approach the bush, and God said, "Hold it, you can't come here. You can't approach this. You're not ready. Take off your shoes. You've got to come before me in humility." And so Moses approaches the bush, and God gives him all of these instructions of what he wants him to do in delivering the people of Israel. And Moses' question is, "Well, who is it that I'm supposed to tell the people that has come and sent me? I have been sent here by a burning bush." What would people think? Who is it that's sending me? And the Lord said simply these very words, I am. That's who's sending me. And so when we find Jesus Christ announcing to John why he should not be afraid, he simply tells him the same thing that he told Moses, because I am. Why should we not be afraid? Simply put, because of who God is. We should not fear because the very God that has delivered his people and cared for his people and historically has been there throughout all of Israel's history and even in our own experience, he has always been there and he always will be because he is. He exists in and of himself. And I'm not here to give you a great theological definition and theology proper or any of that except to remind us we don't want to forget who God is. We don't want to forget what kind of God it is that we worship and serve. We're not worshiping an idol. We're not worshiping something we made with our hands. It's not even the invention of our own mind, and he doesn't reflect our image. Rather, we reflect his. He's not something of our imagination. He is the God who is, the God who exists and has made everything. He is self-sustaining and self-substantial. That's who we worship. So don't be afraid because of who God is. God himself gives us that assurance. He tells us something about his acts. He tells us about what he does in his economy. What is God's work? And God's work is that he is both the beginning and the end. God has written the story. God wrote the first chapter and he has written the last chapter. And everything is working out according to his plan. He put it down beforehand according to the purpose of his will. If Paul will write in Ephesians chapter 1, God has a plan. He has a plan that he's working out, and he is the beginning of it, and he will see it to its consummation. We can trust God because God's in control. He already said, I am the Alpha and the Omega. It's equivalent. The very first in order, but also first in preeminence, and the last. I will be there when everything else is gone. And you and I are going to be gone one of these days. And measurably, it's not that long when we consider history, is it? You and I will be gone. I was sitting there thinking about it. In January, I had one funeral. In February, I had two. This month, well, since Mr. Fontenot passed away, it's going to be six. And yesterday afternoon was a 26-year-old young man who last Saturday went to bed to sleep with an ulcer burning in his stomach. And his mom and the family found him on Monday, and he had bled to death with a bleeding ulcer at 26 years old. You and I, measurably, aren't going to be here very long, are we? You and I will not be around long. Yet, when everything else is gone, God will still be standing. He will be the last, not last man, but he will be the last one standing. God from the beginning to the end. Why should John not be afraid? And why should you and I not be afraid? Because our God's in control of all this. We look around at the mess. You know, I hear the bemoaning, you know, of how pitiful the situation is. God, people look and they say, you know, I just remember the glory of Port Arthur and how pitiful the sum of the situation's got. Well, it's not just Port Arthur. And the reality is that when we're gone and when all of this is gone, God will still be standing. God is certainly in control. And as we depend upon him, there's no reason to be afraid. Last summer, I was taking Trey, and we were going through an area of Port Arthur that most of you would not even travel to visit. In fact, there's not an area in Port Arthur that I'm afraid to go visit. And Trey and I were going, and as we were walking down the street and passing out, doing Bible distribution and talking to people about Christ, he began to point out all the gang insignia painted around. They began to look at all the drug paraphernalia on the sides of the road and all the broken beer bottles and all the brokenness. And he goes, what are you doing having your son down here in this area? I said, it's okay, Trey. We are perfectly safe. Because as John, who wrote the epistle, said, perfect love casts out fear. There is no fear in love. Why should I be afraid? Because greater is he who is in me than he who is in this world. And the one who has chosen me, and the one who loves me, and the one who is keeping me has overcome it all. So what's there to be afraid of? And so in the presence of God, who has written the book and has told us from the beginning and was there in the beginning and will still be there in the end, there is no reason to be afraid. He tells us a third thing about himself, of the reason, of the assurance, of why we should not be afraid. Our God lives. He always lives. He's self-sustaining. He wasn't created. He didn't have a beginning. He won't have an end. Our God lives. But there was something that happened to our God, to this Lord Jesus Christ that we call Lord and Savior. He died. It says he lives, present participle, that's what he does. He always does it. It's always he is alive. But he was dead. It's imperfect. So it looks at it as something that happened in a process. It has beginning and it has its end. He died, but behold, he's still living. Present active participle, it's something that he always does. And his living is always, it's eternal, it's forever and ever. It's for ions of ions of ions. I mean, you can't measure all the length of everything. You know, when we listen to scientists start trying to measure the length of stars and of solar systems and galaxies, and they begin to talk about these huge numbers, that sounds like our national debt. You know, it's just beyond comprehension, isn't it? To begin thinking about the enormity of such numbers, and yet he says, for ions of ions of ions. And so we find that God, who exists, even though he's experienced death, it was all very, very temporary, and it's a very short experience, because our God lives, and he lives, and he lives, and he lives. And he will always live. So why should we not fear it? Because our God lives. What's he going to do? Because in a salvation announcement, besides telling what God has done historically, it also looks to say, what is God going to do now in the current situation? What is God going to do in order to give me assurance now presently? I know what he's done in the past, but how do I know right now that he will do something for me? That I shouldn't be afraid in the situation that I'm in? So what is God going to do? For Joshua, I'm going to be with you. So every step that you take, that land I've already given to you. Be assured of that. For Israel, your enemies will be destroyed. I will go ahead of you and I'll destroy your enemies. Your enemies will be conquered. Don't be afraid. Fear not, because I'm going to be with you. I was with you in the past, so I'm going to be with you now in this temporal circumstance. So what is it that God is going to do for us? He tells us that this is what he's going to do. Present verb. I have. I have the keys. I own this thing. You know, Wayland's got this funny little thing that he says. We were working over in Bridge City with the cleanup over there on that Sunday of Mid-County Kindness. And one of the young ladies was giving Wayland instructions. And he just finally told her, he says, I'm sorry, but you just don't have a license to talk to me that way. And she goes, what? And he says, you don't have a license. She says, what do you mean I don't have a license? He says, Terry's got a license. She can talk to me that way. But you don't have a license, so you can't talk to me that way. You go get a license and you can talk to whoever it is that you want to talk that way, but you don't have a license, so you can't talk to me that way. And he says, because I don't have to listen to you, but I do have to listen to Terry because she's got the license. Well, you know what? He who has the keys owns the car, right? Or the house, or the office. He who has the keys takes possession of it, correct? They own it. It's theirs. And he tells to us that I have the keys of death and hell. I own it. I have control over this. I can lock it. I can open it. You know, in Deuteronomy chapter 30, chapters 28 to 30, is this great... this great promise of assurance, and it's also the declaration of curse if you don't obey God. And in chapter 30, he turns around and he says, okay, so here's your options. You've got the option of either you can turn and repent towards God, you can choose life, or you can choose death. You have the option. God's going to give you the option of choosing life or choosing death. So will you choose life? Will you turn to God? Will you respond to God? Will you seek after God to choose life, or will you continue to pursue the way that you're going and in so have death? Jesus Christ has the keys of death. Why? Because he went to death and he entered the grave and he took death captive. Ephesians chapter 4 says, he took captivity captive. The one that was the captor that held the souls of men and held the fear of men, he has taken it as the victor and has taken the spoils from death, and he owns death. In fact, 1 Corinthians chapter 15 says that he has taken away, he's taken the sting, as it were, off of the power of sin. He's pulled the stinger. You know that a wasp or a bee can only, as long as they got a stinger, they can sting you, right? When the stinger's gone, what can a wasp do if you cut his stinger out? What exactly can he do? Absolutely nothing, can he? He can't hurt you. If you pull the claws and the teeth from a lion, what can a lion do? At best, they can slobber you and waller you to death. But they can't bite you, can they? And they can't claw you. I mean, they might gum you, but I don't think that's going to be life-threatening. So what can they do when you pull the claws and you pull the teeth? Absolutely nothing. So there is no fear of death because the stinger has been pulled. And the power of it has been broken because Christ himself has risen from the grave. And so what has he done? Don't be afraid because death has no power over you. I have the keys. It's all locked up. And hell itself is locked. And he owns the keys. You remember what he said to Peter in Matthew chapter 16. Peter, who do you say that I am? You are the Christ. You are the Son of the God who lives. Flesh and blood didn't show you that, but my Father who is in heaven. And I tell you, Peter, little rock, that upon this foundation rock, Petros, I will build my church, and the gates of hell can't prevail against it. Why? Because he holds the keys. Because he has conquered it, and he has won, and it is the spoil of his victory. So don't be afraid. So because this is true, I want you to write what you've already seen. What has he seen? Well, what he has seen is he has seen the Lord in heaven in all of its glory. I want you to write that down. Before we get any farther, John, I want you to write this down. This is what I want you to write down. Write it down. I don't want you forgetting any of the details. I want you to write what you've seen. John writes it down. Okay, now I want you to see what is. This right now is what I want you to write down. I want you to write down what is. And that will be letters that occur in chapters 2 and 3. And then I want you to write down the things that are about to come after these things, which will be chapters 4 and following. Because if you read over in chapter 4, the very first words are, and after these things, and isn't that what he said? I want you to write down the things that are about to pass after these things I saw. So what's the things that are? Everything he has to say to the churches. So what's he want to tell us? Well, there's a mystery. There's a mystery that God... Well, what is a mystery? What exactly... How many of you like mysteries? You know, I guess, yeah, some do, some don't. Probably when I was growing up, the only kind of literature I liked to read was mysteries. You know, all of the, like The Hound and The Bastard Filled and those, anything that had some kind of suspense to it, you know, I liked mystery. Poetry, romance, you know, just didn't do anything for me. Something like The Jungle, you know, the Chicago meat packing, you know, that was kind of cool for a guy to read about all the, you know, nastiness of the meat packing factories. Romance and novels just didn't do much for me, but a mystery, I could get into that. Well, there's a mystery. And the mystery is what he saw. What did he see? He saw seven stars. Besides the seven stars, he saw, and they were in the right hand, the very hand that he reached down and touched John with. You remember? It says they're in his right hand, verse 16. He holds them in his right hand, the seven stars. And he reached down and he touched John with what? He touched him with his right hand. And so these stars that you see in my right hand, well, they mean something. And when I was standing there among the seven lampstands that were golden, well, within the tabernacle and the temple, there was only one lampstand. It was a menorah. In fact, the word is menorah. And it had seven branches, six on, you know, three on each side, and then one comes up the middle. And so you look, and normally you would just see one lampstand with seven pipes, three on each side, one main one coming up in the middle, and all of this decoration and the decorative stuff. But here there are seven separate lampstands, and each one of these lampstands is golden. And so I want you to know what the mystery is. The mystery is here I'm in the midst of them. Here's the mystery. The stars are the angels of the church. Well, some say that's the preacher. I have never been called an angel since my grandma died. Pray, am I an angel?
No.
So I know that that one can't be true. You know, it can't be the preacher, because the preacher's not an angel, right? So it's not the preacher. So you mean there's an angel that is to each assigned to each church? Well, do you believe that is possible? That you and I could have an angel that is kind of watching over the things that go on? Let me give you just kind of put something out in your ear. Hebrews chapter 1, right there at the end of the chapter. He says, are not angels ministering spirits who are sent to care for those who are inheriting salvation? Well, who's inheriting salvation? You and I are, aren't we? Aren't we the heirs of salvation? And so if it says that the angels are ministering spirits that are sent on behalf of those who are inheriting salvation, then wouldn't you think that that congregation wouldn't have at least one of them watching over us? Watching over the things that are going on? So there's a mystery that what we do here presently, that we're not doing this alone. In fact, Peter says in chapter 1 about verse 12 that the angels in heaven that are still in heaven, they're like this. I mean, they're at the balcony and they're peeking over the edge of the balcony. They didn't get the good seats. You know, if you go to the football game and you get season tickets, where do you want to be? You want to be in the nosebleed section or you want to be down the 50-yard line? Where do you want to be? 50-yard line. If you go to the NCAA tournaments, where do you want to be? All the way at the top in the third section, in the third balcony? Is that where you want to be? Or do you want to be right down in the middle so you can see the whole thing and maybe catch a basketball or a body flying over, flying over into the crowd? Where do you want to be? If you're going to be up there, you might as well watch it at home on TV, right? Because it's just going to be loud and noisy and sweaty and there's going to be a whole lot you're going to miss. I mean, don't you want to be there? And so the angels stuck in heaven, Paul says, or Peter says, they're like this. I mean, they're not even in their seat. They're leaning over the balcony, looking into this great salvation to see what sort of person and what manner of time that the prophets were preaching about. They're looking into the salvation. So if they're looking from heaven, watching and observing, and Paul says in Ephesians chapter 3 that this mystery of Jew and Gentile together is being played out in this panorama of this drama, of this open air kind of a coliseum where, the seats are up. Have you ever been to the Passion Play at Eureka Springs? All right, so you know exactly what it is. The play is played up here on the stage, and you sit up there on the mountainside, and you got all these chairs, and that's the picture. I mean, that's an old Greek and Roman style amphitheater. You sit in the bleachers, and you watch everything going along, and the drama of God, of this mystery of God, of God's salvation. In fact, Paul uses this term mystery in Ephesians quite frequently. In chapter 1 and verse 9, in chapter 3 and verse 3, and verse 4 and verse 9, use it again in chapter 5, where he talks about the husband and wife, and he says, this is the mystery. I'm speaking about Christ in the church. He uses it again in chapter 6 when he talks in verse 23, when he says that a door to be able to preach the mystery of the gospel. And so here's this mystery, that God is superintending what's being done. That there is an agent that's responsible for this. That he has issued for us someone to watch over the work that we're doing. So why should we be afraid? If God's watching over and caring for the very work that he's committed us to do, why should we be afraid on any given situation? Last Sunday morning at 8 o'clock in Maryville, Illinois, Keith Winters was standing to preach in the early morning service. And a man came in the church who was very frustrated and angry at something, and nobody knows yet. And he opened fire and he killed the pastor. And then he turned with a knife to attack and assault some of the people in the church. Why didn't you stay home this morning? Why were you not terrified that this morning some may come in here and open fire on me and open fire on some of you? Why didn't you stay home? Are you not afraid? What is there to be afraid of? If I die today, if I die before I get home this afternoon, what have I lost? I might miss a few things. I might miss the opportunity of seeing grandkids get married and see them graduate from school, then get married. I might miss, seeing Trey graduate from high school and seeing him finish college and get married and start. I might miss out on a few things, but what am I going to lose? Absolutely nothing. For me to live is Christ. For me to die is what? Gain. Do you really believe that? God watches over everything that we're doing. And you and I stand in the presence of all of heaven. What we do as a congregation. So oftentimes we think individually. We think about me and my, it's kind of like that country and western song. I want to talk about me. I want to talk about my. I want to talk about number one. John could probably sing it better than I can. That's us in the Christian life, isn't it? I want to talk about me. I want to talk about my needs. I want to talk about what I like, what I want in a worship service, what I want to do. I want to talk about me. But we find that it's not about me. It's not just the Rick Warren book. It's not just about me, but it's about us. Paul says in Ephesians 2, or chapter 1, that we've been saved together. We have been raised together. We have been seated together. A basketball team in the championship and the tournaments, the regional tournaments they just had this weekend, to finish it up, they either won or lost as a team. They didn't win or lose as an individual. When a guy standing off trying to make a desperation shot at a three-point range at the last second and missing it didn't lose the game, the team lost the game. And the guy that makes it, doesn't even get to half court, and he slings that thing up there and he drops it in right before the buzzer sounds, he didn't win the game. The team won the game. And they win or lose together as a team. And you and I don't win and lose as individual Christians. We win or lose as a team because we together have a lampstand. And our lampstand is in the presence of God, and it is what we do with that lampstand because the threat to each one of the churches we're going to see in chapters 2 and 3, the threat isn't that individual Christians are going to be taken out, but the church will. That we will win or lose together. That we will stand before the Lord and we will honor Him together or we will dishonor Him together. Not as individuals, but corporately as a body. God looks at what we're doing. We're in the presence of Jesus Christ. Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid to be your light before God and to be your light before the world. Don't be afraid. Look at the value of this. We think about the value of all that we have to offer and what we don't have to offer. But look at the character of this lampstand. What is it made of? Well, that old church member over there, they just don't do anything. They're just kind of worthless. They don't contribute anything. They're always assuming everything. But it seems to me like this isn't a mixture, is it? It's not a brass lampstand that is partly wood and it maybe has a little bit of this and a little bit of that. The lampstand is entirely made of what? Gold. And back in the Old Testament, the lampstand, the menorah that stood in the tabernacle, was made of 75 pounds of pure gold. Nothing else. A pure gold. And the gold was hammered out of one piece. Sometimes God has to knock us around to get His fashion to look like what we ought to look like, doesn't He? He has to beat on us a little bit, but underneath it's still gold because that's what He's created us to be. Don't be afraid. We go through trials, we go through struggles, it's okay. Don't be afraid, but see it as heaven sees it. Don't look at it the way you see it. Now, I close with this illustration. I know that I've given it before, but I hope you will permit me at least this time. But there was a gentleman that I know that was a kind of my mentor in ministry, S. Lewis Johnson. When he finished up his seminary training, he was pastoring, and it was right at the end of the Great Depression. There was a woman that her husband had left her with three kids. She was struggling along trying to make ends meet. She was doing a lot of sewing and things, just trying to struggle along to make a subsistence existence. And so Dr. Johnson had gone out to talk to her because she quit coming to church. She was very depressed because her husband had deserted her with the kids. And he went out, and he's trying to talk to her, and she just wouldn't listen. She's sitting there, and she was kind of sewing. I don't know exactly what you'd call the sewing, but she was making a pillow cover with, you know, some kind of a decoration in it, a scene. She's making it, sewing it to give to someone else. And as she is sewing away, and she really wasn't paying attention, finally, Dr. Johnson just looked at her, and he said, "You know, that's got to be the ugliest thing I've ever seen." And she just stopped, and she looked at him, and she was, "Not only are you a sorry comfort, but you're also stupid." And she took that thing and flipped it over because he saw the backside of it where all the strings were sticking out, where everything was tied off. And she flipped it over and she goes, "You're looking at the wrong side." She said, "Here's where the beauty is." And there's this beautiful scene that she had been sewing on. And he says, "Madam, I may be a sorry comfort, but I'm not the one that's stupid. You are." He said, "Because you've been looking at what God's doing in your life from the wrong side. And if you could see it from God's side, you'd see something very different. But while you're looking at the strings and you're looking at the mess, not wondering what in the world has God done to forsake me here, you just need to flip it around and see it from God's side for just a moment. Because what God is doing in your life is very beautiful, and God is there making a beautiful picture. And if you could see it from His side, oh, what a difference it would be. You never missed another Sunday." With all the struggle she had raising the three kids, she got support from the congregation, but she never missed another Sunday, and she never forgot that experience. But someone would be honest with us. You know, it may not be politically correct to tell someone that they're stupid, but Paul said, "Brothers, I'd not have you to be ignorant." You know, there's a lot of things we don't know. There's a lot of things we don't see. And our perspective may not be the right perspective in some of the things that we go through. But for just a moment, we could see Jesus Christ in all His glory. But we could realize that from the beginning to the end, He's in control. And the very thing that threatens us the most, which is our own mortality, He's already taken control of that. Because He lives, and He lives forever and ever and ever. And He holds the very keys of the thing that threatens us the most. So what's there to be afraid of if our God's in control? As we stand, has God spoken to your own heart that there's a decision you need to make publicly? Then come. Don't put it off. Come. Because God has a plan for our church and for your life. Be a part of it. Of God's plan. Know the presence of the Lord.